Hey everyone, welcome to Talking Split for some episode. I'm not entirely sure what number we are.
35, Robbie.
35. Have not done my research on this one. I am Rob Calder, Coach Development Officer at Basketball Victoria. With me, I have all things in charge of high performance, Mike Zeppel, country, metro, anywhere in between.
Robbie, how are you, mate?
Very, very well. A big apology to our listeners for our lack of show last week. Time clearly got the better of us, but it is one of those things where you don't realise how much you missed until you don't produce something.
And then the uproar was minimal, so
Nothing at all.
We weren't missed.
Nothing at all. It is a minor miracle we've managed to come back in this week. But a big shout out to those of you that do subscribe to the show, do download it every week, rate, review, like, share, retweet. We do appreciate everyone's time. We do have a guest this week.
Done well, Robbie. Done well.
A big name.
The biggest that we've had, Robbie.
I believe so. We'll rattle off the resume just before we introduce her. But
that might take a minute.
That may take a little bit longer than we thought, but we'll get started with our guest now. So welcome back, everyone. As mentioned earlier, we do have another guest on. Always good when we have guests in for the podcast. We are lucky enough to have, and I'll read out some very brief credentials, otherwise we'll go for the full half hour, 45 minutes with our guest. Order of Australia, Basketball Victoria Wall of Fame, FIBA Hall of Fame, three-time Olympic Games, four times World Championships, 264 games for the Opals, 285 WNBL games, seven-time All-Star, Euro Cup National Champion, first Australian in the WNBA and to be a professional in Europe, 116 WNBA games for the Phoenix Mercury. I hope everyone has worked out who this is by now. We have Michelle Timms in for the podcast. Timms, thank you very much for jumping in. Greatly appreciate it.
Nah, happy to be here, and I didn't know some of those stats, so that's good. Thanks.
This sounds like Robbie's resume.
Mine goes for about 2 seconds.
Northwest Cricket Hall of Fame.
Yeah, bad domestic player, I think, is where mine sort of capped out at. But wealth of experience, obviously. Fun time of year, of course. So Phoenix Mercury royalty, jersey retired there at the moment. Just have been rolled, unfortunately, in the WNBA finals a couple of weeks back.
Disappointing.
It was, but great series with the Seattle Storm as well. Like, you caught most of that?
Yeah, I just still can't, I just still don't get how they didn't beat Seattle, you know. And now it's gone to the final series. I'm just so not interested. It's like such a yawn fest, and Seattle will win it for sure, but yeah, just disappointed in Phoenix, to be honest. I really thought they had the stock to get it done. And especially when Birdie went down and then their lack of leadership there, you know, anyway. But
it's great series, though.
Yeah,
like, that's
it was.
Seattle-Phoenix. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That was crazy. How was some of the score? The pure offensive scoring was, Taurasi was just...
She's amazing, mate.
She is a freak. It was so fun to watch.
And that's probably my favourite.
Yeah, and that's the one thing. Like, when you watch it or if you see the highlights on YouTube or whatever it shows up on, the hoop is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, some of the step back three in the corner from Taurasi, the Sue Bird overhead passes.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's exceptional.
Out of control. And obviously a great Australian heritage at Phoenix as well. So you obviously got drafted there or played there. Cary Graff was there, former Australian Opals coach. Sandy's there at the moment. Steph Talbot's there.
Christy Harrow was there. Michelle Brogan was there. There's been so many Aussies. Kristen Veal was there. So many Aussies through that door in Phoenix.
And that Phoenix-Seattle rivalry has always been a really good one.
With LJ and Tully Bevilacqua and Birdie.
That's incredible.
Even when I played, like, Seattle weren't, they weren't like the LA or Houston or anything like that, but it was such great rivalry back then playing against LJ and Sandy Brondello was playing with them as well then. Geez, that is going back, isn't it? I'm old. Dang.
No.
But in a lot of ways, really sort of paved the road, I think, for a lot of young Australian athletes coming through as well, with the likes of yourself going through the WNBA and the amount of WNBA athletes we've had over the last decade, 20 years or so. It's a great pathway for a lot of young Australians at the moment. And we've got the likes of Rebecca Allen currently playing at the moment. Sammy Whitcomb is over there.
Yeah, Lani how good she? I'm really excited to see Whitcomb in the Opals team. Yeah, fantastic. And I mean, we need this pure shooter too. And I'm so excited to see game one. I can't wait for the start of the World Cup and seeing the Opals, how they're going
to
go. And with Big Liz now, if Liz wasn't there, I think we'd struggle a little bit because the USA's up here and the rest of the world's like this, I reckon. And if Liz hadn't have put her hand up for that tournament, I reckon we could have been in a, it would have been a huge battle. But with Liz there now, and then hearing Sammy Watkins join the crew, I can't wait to see them
it's
play.
It's going to be a fun tournament.
Yeah, it really is.
Next month, it's going to be really good to watch.
Yeah, it really is. And they've got the FIBA app too that people can download and and
watch
follow. Yeah, watch it all.
It'll be high quality. Like, I'm shocked at the moment of just how good. To be perfectly honest, I hadn't followed WNBA for probably a couple of years and then all of a sudden jumped back into it this last 12, 18 months. I'm staggered at how good it is. Like, some of the ladies coming out of college are out of control good. Brianna Stewart is amazing. Can do everything.
Yeah.
Eleanor Delanon, same deal. Can do everything. And then, like, Sue Bird's played how many years in the league? Like, rolls in with a broken nose again.
Yeah.
And just puts teams on her back and wins.
It drives a lot of what we talk about here on the pod, but also in high performance in Victoria, is that you have to be unbelievably skilled to compete at that level.
Mm.
Like, they're all very good athletes, but the shooting ability is extraordinary. The dexterity, those girls play on both sides of their body. They can pass with both hands. They can pivot on both feet. And then the style of play in the WNBA is one that is resembled in Europe. Like, they're playing a lot of ball screen action. If you're open, you're expected to knock the shot down. And I think that just helps with the growth of the league.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Timsy, you're someone that's played in Europe, in, you know, all over the world, obviously, and WNBA. What are the different styles depending on the region that you played in? Like, is basketball not the same?
You know, it's evolving into... I think it's become very, very similar. You know, obviously the Asian style is a little bit different with the way the Japanese play and the Chinese, although the Chinese became a little bit more Westernised, I think. Japanese, all about the flare screens, and they create such great space and they're so quick, you know, putting that ball on the floor and getting into the lane and being able to hit the open, you know, the open man and nail that three, you know. And then there's the on-ball. The on-ball's that's the world game right now is, you know, and the team that can defend the on-ball the best is the team that's probably going to be the best, I think. I mean, obviously the ones who can score off it, but if you can defend it, and that's the magic thing, isn't it? That's the hardest thing, is knowing how to defend the on-ball the best. There's so many different ways you can go about it, but on-balls have really taken over the game internationally, I think, not just the WNBA, but in Europe. And although I must admit, I watch the European national teams, but I don't see the club system much, so I don't know. But I imagine it's still the same as the international scene, and that is a heap of on-balls clearing out, you know, one side, two-man games, you know. So I'm pretty much thinking it's all the same.
It's a great point. Something we spoke about often is, so your 4-on-4 shell drill that was historically done every practice for 10 minutes and it starts off just jumps the ball, jumps the ball.
San Antonio,
You now need to have a 4-on-4 shell that incorporates defending.
Absolutely.
Defending every ball screen in the seam, on the wing, in the middle.
And having a strong side corner, having that weak side, you know, the strong side cleared out, and all the different formations of your on balls.
Yep.
It's really important you have great defensive rules on knowing how you're going to defend it, and at the same time, the more you practice it defensively, the better you're going to become at it offensively.
And even screeners that can shoot the three now, it is such a valuable trait. Like those stretch fours, like Jackson was probably one of the first that went through.
Actually, I'll take you back. Jenny Whittle, here's one for you. Jenny Whittle was she was just a flat out five man, but she could come down on that trail and nail the three. And it's just, for my memory, she was the first big player that Australia ever had that did that, you know, could shoot the three, no worries. And it was a real key factor for the Opals back in the day. And then Jackson came along and just, you know, turned everything
front upside
down. Changed the way the game was played in the world, I think.
Yep. No question. And I think it's a really important message for a lot of coaches, is that if you do get a taller athlete, don't just stick him in the post and say, hey, go rebound and put back and that'll be your deal for the next 20 years of your playing career. They have to be able to shoot the ball. And if they can't shoot the ball, they can't play. Like, it's screener or
it's too easy scout.
Yeah.
If they can't, you know.
No question. Yeah. I think it's a really important part of it. So when you look at the style when you played, like, were there as many on-ball screens?
Oh, no. It was different. It was more coming off the staggers and turnouts. And so the on-ball wasn't as many on-balls involved when I was playing. And, you know, you look at the different, you're talking about different styles and different eras and that, and, you know, the athletes now are such better athletes, you know. We were never as athletic and dynamic as the kids these days. Yeah. So IQ was probably a bit higher.
That's where I was going to head next.
So we had a better IQ, yeah.
And it's a comment that a lot of coaches make is that we have fantastic athletes, but our IQ isn't necessarily great. Yeah. Is that something you feel like has probably dropped off a little bit with the level of
athleticism? I don't know if it's dropped off. Look, when I went to that was one thing that when I very first time I went to the WNBA, I found out that they found the Americans weren't, like, they were all really athletically really gifted. But their IQ of the game was nothing like the Australians. Like the Australians, Australian IQ, our IQ was, we always had good IQ, you know, brought up with good IQs. And maybe that's because of the coaches that we had and also understanding where we were in the state of the game in regards to, like we were always a small team. And so I guess we had to find ways of winning other than dominating, you know, IQ came into it a lot and coaches really coached the game back then. And when I went to the States, that's the thing, the biggest difference was the Americans might have been more athletic, but the Australians really knew the game and knew IQ-wise was through the roof in comparison to a lot of the players.
Yeah, and that's the flavour of the NBA and WNBA as well has changed and it has become an international game now. And the three-point shot, crazy stat was, you know, 2007, Phoenix shot 25 threes per game for that whole year. And they're the only team.
What was their percentage, do you know?
Yeah, probably decent, mid-30s.
Yeah.
This past year, 25 teams shot 25 or more threes per game. So you can just see the evolution of the game. In a decade.
Like back then, they were almost ragged on.
Well, and that was
the scary part.
Yeah. That was the tone of the article, was that, yeah, Phoenix were ragged on back then for being this bailout three-point shooting team, and now it is the norm. And you have to make threes to win.
Isn't that, you know, you can talk about, you know, international hoop with the national teams too, from a junior level to the seniors, you know. You look at the teams that win and the teams that lose, and generally the teams, I mean, it's going to sound bleeding obvious, but the team that doesn't put the ball in the hole, but usually it's the team that has such a poor three-point percentage that doesn't get it done. And I think that's one of the things that Australia in the past haven't been necessarily great at shooting the ball, you know, and that opens a whole other can of worms of what we need to be rehearsing and practicing back here in Australia. More and more and more is our shooting. And, you know, you just talk to people like Ian Stacker and they, you know, they can prattle off stats. And, you know, they have really good feel for... And you just have to look at the stats. The stats don't lie. You look at the national championships and you go, wow, that team shot, you know, no wonder they didn't win on top of a lot of other reasons, but their three-point percentage is just so poor.
Well, and it's funny because that and free throws are the ones that stand out straight away. Like, your field goal percentage kind of is what it is. Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter too much, but I usually go to a three-point percentage and free throws, and it's like, well, there's your game straight away.
Yeah. And then I go to turnovers too, and I like to have a crack at the rebounds as well. But yeah, exactly. I always quickly flick and say, have a look at that at three-point percentages.
Interesting one, Timsy. Someone on this podcast a couple of weeks ago did say that shooting was really undervalued here in Australia and in Melbourne historically. Like, it was probably the first thing that I identified. And I went through those national championships, like the last five or six that Victoria Metro played in. And I'm talking high teens, low 20s for a week away, which is just isn't going to get it done. So,
and then you look at the national team, I think the under-17s or towards the back end of the tournament also didn't shoot the three ball very well, you know, and it's not odd that it's kind of a bit of an Achilles heel for Australian national teams, or I kind of think anyway it has been, even though I've been out of the game a little bit.
Yeah. And it needs to be addressed, and we're addressing it within our department. I just finished reading a book about basketball analytics, kind of NBA, late 90s, early 2000s, and the bleeding obvious is you make more shots, you win.
Yeah.
But that is the stat across the NBA, is your field goal percentage is correlated directly to wins and losses, which would say you should probably invest some time in shooting the basketball and a style of play that does create rhythm.
And it's amazing how many times you talk to coaches about team selection, they say, and you say, well, why didn't you pick this kid that's a great shooter? And they're like, oh, yeah, but they can't defend. And it's like, well, I feel like we can probably teach that a little bit easier than we can the outstanding
game
defender
for it,
to be able to shoot the ball. Like, it's shooting is just such a lost art.
It's interesting because I'm a real defensive. I love the D, and I'm all about the D. And I spend a lot of time at my academy on the defense. But, you know, I think knowing how to shoot the ball and putting the ball in the hole, you know, I'm starting to sway back that, you know, you got to spend. And also the other thing is that I wonder, do the coaches know how to you know, how to break that shot down and actually teach it. And when you get into a, when you're at your club system and you get into, you know, training, you really don't have that time to break that skill down for each of the players. So maybe it's just, it's not, it's getting glossed over. Okay, let's just do this shooting drill. But so you're chucking up numbers and you're filling your 2 minutes that you've set aside at training, but you're not actually helping that person with their shot. So actually the breakdown, which is always tricky because you've only got a certain amount of hours each week with your team. So the kids, you can tell them to go out, but if they're shooting with their you know, bad timing or their elbow out or whatever technically is flawed and they're not getting assisted on how to correct it, then it doesn't matter how many times they get out in the backyard, I don't think they're going to put the ball in the hole at a high percentage.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, and it's really hard.
And there are so many athletes now and so many kids playing on a Friday night, and clubs have gotten so big that it is hard to get that information to all the kids, where historically, you know, you would have had 20 kids playing under 18 girls basketball. All 20 can come to a shooting day. We can check all their shots. We can teach them all technique. But it is a big one for us.
Especially now, we have the technology available to actually give feedback to athletes, like the use of video, iPads, iPhones, all those sorts of things. We can video someone's shot technique and correct it fairly quickly and send them on their way again. So it is something I think as coaches we need to spend a little bit more time doing, is correcting it. Like when you were starting to play, like, so your technique, fairly solid, it'd be fair to say. Was that reps or was that coached into you, or was it a sort of an element of both when you were coming through the path?
I think I was really fortunate that I had really good high intellectual coaches as a junior who really knew their stuff. So, and drilled into you. I think we only trained once a week, didn't we, back then, back in those days on a Sunday morning, you know. But lots of reps and out in the backyard and just the reinforcement of the key words and off you went, you know. And especially by the time I got to Tom Ma, in my seniors and being taught by him, and just, you know, he really grinded your shot and was really, really technical about, you know. So you'd shoot hundreds and hundreds of shots and he'd just stand there going, dirt, 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 and be like, oh, for, you know, like, yes, okay, 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 you know. And then those words just hang in your head and it's, you, it's you do your self-check.
It's boring and it's tedious, but it is that numbing process that you've got to go through to get to being elite at that skill. Have you got some shot thoughts or things that you can remember that you went through when you were practicing your shooting, or some trigger words or keywords?
Oh, look,
that...
the keywords, you know, and I teach the kids who come to my academy that, that you need to, don't overthink it, of course, but if you find you're going on a tear and you just... each time you're shooting it, it's the same result. You've got to come up with a keyword. So I teach them about keywords, of whether it's something to do with their legs, they're not getting into their shot enough, or just might be simple like target, just something really short and quick that they can say to themselves, so it makes them really lock in on what they're about to do. Yeah,
I think the target ones are really interesting.
You know what it is?
A lot of kids don't look.
Yeah, and they get their head up. They do this flick where they get their head up as the ball's going up, and it's way too late, you know. But and also the other thing about target, it's one thing saying target but then it's actually doing the Michael Jordan thing and being able to lock in, like hone in, you know. That's what made him such a great player to a degree. His shooting was unreal because he could really get to a point on that rim that he really locked into. Just naturally, and you say to the kids, target or head up or get, you know, but that thing's big, and you just can't look at that big thing, that big ring. You've got to lock it into a certain part or a certain back keyhole on the little loop of the net, or just to really focus in on it. Yeah,
brilliant. So you mentioned Tom Maher. So obviously you played for him when you were going through your playing career, and then assisted him moving into the China scene. So for those of you that aren't aware, you probably haven't seen Timsy around a whole lot over the last couple of years. You've been plying your trade over in China with their national team and through all their pathways as well. What's the dynamic like with you and Tom? And was it difficult moving from that, he's my coach, to now I'm assisting him?
No, not at all. I guess as a point guard too, you're always a little bit of an extension of your coach anyway. You're the quarterback out there. And so for my playing years, I felt, although I didn't realise it at the time, when I look back, it was like, well, maybe I was like a little assistant of his out there anyway. But I actually moved away and hadn't come across Tom for a while, and then went back many years later, and then I think it was like 8 years later, and then came, started working under Tom. So actually it was probably, 7 years later after I retired. So I'd had time away, and then it was great, you know, just fantastic. By far the best coach I've ever had. And to have an opportunity to work with him and continue, like to start my new career as an assistant coach, even though I'd coached a little bit prior. But to actually get back to how do you coach something? You know, it's one thing being a player and who's played for Australia, but how do you actually teach that now? And so there's a lot of players out there who play the game, but they used to play the game at a high level, but do they know how to break the teaching points down or the skill down of actually teaching it something, you know? And so I was really lucky to go straight under back with the best and then learn how to, you know, come out the other end and actually teach those points that just came naturally for me after hearing it for so many years.
Was there any, I suppose, frustration from your end moving from playing into coaching where it's like, I kind of want to still play and I want to be able to swim
sure.
And things like,
sometimes like, I'm like, how can you guys be so stupid? Like, this is easy. You know, like, how do you not get this? Yep. You know, like, for sure. But bite the tongue and, you know, and the longer you're in the coaching game, that you know, you get it. And look, these athletes now have way surpassed me, like, with what they can do and how gifted they are. Like, even with you, I look at the under 12 kids. And it's like I've been watching a lot of the under 12s and 14s over the last Friday nights now that I'm back. And I'm just amazed at the skill level of some of those kids. You know, at that level, that took me to under 18 to be able to do the stuff that they're doing now, you know, like with the particularly the handles.
Handles is the big one. I know speaking with some collegiate coaches who used to have to spend the freshman year teaching ball handling, the kids come in now as pretty good ball handlers. So you can figure out what else there is to teach and you know, change your skill progression from there. Timsy, I was 15 years old in the year 2000.
Okay.
When the Olympics were in Sydney. Right. I remember.
Not turning into a Timsy roaster.
Yeah, right.
I remember.
Who's coming through that door? No.
I remember watching the Olympics from my house in Hoppers Crossing and the gold medal game against the US. Mm. Tell us about, not the gold medal game, but just tell us about your Olympic experiences and what
I
it was.
I will tell you about the gold medal game. I think that was really disappointing. Yeah, representing the country, there's nothing like it. Yeah. You know, there's nothing like putting on the green and gold. And they have, like, how lucky to have the opportunity to play in the Olympics in your own backyard. I mean, the last one was 56. I think it's going to be sooner. We won't have to wait so long again for it to come back. But really extremely fortunate. And I was at the end of my career. I was banged up and injured. And I was lucky enough to be captain of this team, and a team that really, when I look back, we blew it and we could have won that gold medal. We were having the best tournament out of all the teams, and we were playing better than the Americans. Then to come to that gold medal game, and we just blew it by not following what Tom had put in place. You know, the game plan, we totally went away with it, which had been a really strong point for us throughout the throughout the tournament, and why we'd been too good. But I think the occasion just got the better of us, and we went back. I think my recollection, and it might not be it, you know, it's funny what you remember, is that we just sort of, we went away from what did us, what got us there in the first place, and we just went back to what we used to do occasionally when we didn't have our heads on, was just throw the ball to Lauren and just say, go do it, you know. And so I think we went, my recollection, might be wrong, but we went back to that and away from the game plan, and we blew it, you know. But Lauren was superb, and it was her coming of age, and she never looked back. So that was great.
Awesome. Now, we obviously wrapped. That was a really good Olympics for us across the board.
It's the best
in
Olympics.
All sports.
Yeah.
And it was just awesome to have it, like you said, in our backyard.
Yeah.
But for our country to do well in various sports, the men played off for bronze, and the, you know, we were great in the pool, and
yeah, it was huge, the Olympics, because, like, you know, 96, in my humble opinion, was a bit of a disaster. Mm. From an athlete's point of view, it felt really corporately not corrupt, but that was the focus of the Olympics, which I understand money's involved and it's, you know, a corporate thing, but it kind of, the whole point of the athlete felt, being the athlete over there, you felt like it got lost. And, you know, when you have an Olympic village that has like 10 McDonald's stores in, and, you know, and then you have this,
someone might be sponsoring this thing.
And then you have your bus drivers go on strike, you know, you have so many things went wrong, and it just, from the athlete's point of view, I'm sure from the outside it looked great and everything because they know how to put on a show, but I was worried going into 2000 whether we were going to make the same mistakes. But, and knowing that the roads in Sydney were so horrible and traffic was a nightmare, how the heck's it going to work? But never been prouder to be an Australian than to be one at those Olympics. And at the end of the day, what made those Olympics were the volunteers and everyone who put their hand up to be part of it and put on this just most amazing show for us. And it was the first time in my life that I ever felt like people wanted to beat their chest and say they were Aussies. Like, you know, the Americans do that a lot. They, you know, they're real proud of who they are, but we're proud, but we never beat our chests over it. And it was just wonderful. People, you know, you get on a train or on public transport on your day off and you'd get on there and people would recognise you and everyone would start singing, you know, Kookaburra sits in there or some sort of Australian song, you know. It was just an amazing period. Yeah.
No, it was, and being 15, 16 myself, it was huge for my development. But in the schoolyard, it was the same thing. Like, yeah. it was great support behind obviously basketball clubs here as well, getting behind the country and hoping it. And we're seeing it right now as well because we're going to have a pretty good men's team.
We'll be medaling next Olympics.
And our women are always strong. Yeah. Hey, you said Tom was the best coach you ever played for. What was that coach quality that he had, and what coach quality have you seen in great coaches that you think, yeah, they're a good coach because they are blank?
Oh, look, he's ever evolving. I think that's what, like, when I look back at Tom now, is that he continues to evolve. He doesn't think he knows everything, and it amazed me with his continual evolution. And I wouldn't have known that as a player, obviously. But I definitely see that now. That's what makes him so continually current, and having had coached five different Olympic teams. But as a player, I think that he knew how to communicate and get the best out of everyone, and he got everyone to buy into it. I guess is the word. You know, like everyone felt like they were part of the decision making on the direction of the team and how we played, and everyone had ownership, and so that communication. I think that's and his knowledge are two of the things that I think why he's so great. He was such a great leader for our program, let alone the team. I mean, that's a bit skimmed over it, but yeah, definitely the communication and the empowering of the player, making them, you know.
So obviously a really proud Australian moment, but how did you go coaching against Australia?
Hated it.
With China?
Terrible, horrible. I just wish the floorboards would just gobbled me up, you know. It was like, can I pull a sickie at this Olympic game, you know, like, and I'm just the assistant coach, so I don't know how anyone feels coaching or playing against, you know, your country, but it's very awkward. I don't like it. It's never sat well with me.
Is forgiven, Timsy, always forgiven.
but always, you know, when I wasn't working or whatever and I'm watching a game, oh, you're obviously, you know, supporting the Opals, but or the Boomers or whatever, but it was always a bit awkward. It was, and you know, what's worse is that we always got smashed, so it was like, it was always a tad embarrassing.
Makes sense. So you've obviously been in the China pathway a lot. What are some of the things that China do better or worse than Australian basketball at the moment? So the system itself?
It's a totally different system, and it's a full-time system. So the kids are plucked out of their environment at a very early age and put into it and nurtured through an elite system of coaching where they're in camp, be it in Beijing or somewhere else, and they train basically 6 days a week, and that's a lot of training. And
it's music to my ears, Timsy.
Yeah, well, it definitely, you know, it's an interesting pathway. It's very different to what we do here. You know, like, for example, a typical day with the national team. Since the last current Chinese coach took over the women's team after Tom left, they've gone back to, like, Tom was very Western in his approach and tried to freshen the girls up and understood the importance, as all good coaches do, of letting your body recover and keeping training sessions short and sharp so you can be dynamic and not to drag them out, because then you're just rehearsing slosh and you don't want to do that. But then there's the Chinese mentality that more is better, and, you know, Canem, and so right now they're back into that mode, and you know, they've just won the Asian Cup, and a typical day for them would be, you know, 7 o'clock up, breakfast, off to the training venue, train from 9 till probably 12, and then head back, have lunch, have a rest, then get back to the gym at 3, and then they could go to 7:30, and it's not for the faint-hearted.
Interesting.
It's not.
Wow.
It's really full on. Yeah, and then every second day they'll do they'll split one of those tour days up with a training a weight session in between, a strength and conditioning session. So so every say Tuesday and Thursday they'll do a strength and conditioning session, and
Do those really full on. Do those athletes play within the Chinese Pro League, or do they go?
They go. Well, it depends when the tournament is. So they can go, say, from the end of their WNBL season, for example, is February, March, and then they'll go all the way through to September. So what's that? March, April, March? 8 months? Seven, eight months? And then they'll flip, and then their WNBL season will start in, November. So it's tumultuous. And those who aren't in that program will stay with their club teams, and they'll be together for 12 months. So it's a 12-month gig, and they'll have a big off-season, and they'll go overseas usually for training camps and play some American teams or to Europe and that. Mm. And,
It's a heck of a system. Like, I suppose when you were playing, you came through, there was nothing like that in Australia. There weren't too many full-time athletes in any sport, really, at that point, whereas the China system is you are not just full-time, you're owned effectively.
Yeah.
Your time is split between on-court and travelling to and from a court almost.
Yeah.
It's incredible to sort of see the amount of work that goes
in. It's a really different system. And so, sometimes it's hard to get your head around, because you come from this mentality where, you know, especially towards the end of my career, it was all about looking after your body. And now it's very much so about how do you get the best out of the athlete. Mm. And so you go into a system that's that has a different philosophy in that. And that takes a little bit to get your head around and, you know, not accept, but just get your head around.
How did you go? I'm taking a wild guess at this. Your Chinese wasn't fantastic when you first went across there as a coach.
I don't know. Yeah, no, it was terrible. No, it still is. Yeah. Yep.
So how did you go dealing with a translator, trying to get the message
across?
Very funny.
Yeah. Look, basketball is a universal language, isn't it? So lucky in that manner. And when I first went across there, I could still play a little bit. Move around. Nowadays a little bit stiffer and the knees are banged up a little bit, but so a lot of demonstration. But my translator, best friend over there, you know, Lulu's his name, and we still, you know, in contact with each other, but he was hopeless, you know. No, at the start he was hopeless. He couldn't speak much English, you know, and he's my translator, and you're only as good as your translator, right? And so I remember one session, I tell this story to nearly everyone I talk about China to, and God love him, he's just a wonderful guy. But and he didn't want to disappoint you, you know, so he just makes stuff up that he thought you were saying. Right. So I remember in China, they, you know, I didn't like to mother the kids. I like to give them some, you know, like teach them about leadership. And instead of having the coach run down the end and line them up into groups of four, which is what they tend to do over there, I just, you know, like, come on, guys, you're under 16, you're under 14, let's organise yourself on the baseline, groups of four. And then I turned my back because I didn't want any coaches to go near them and help them and just see if they could do it, you know, a very simple task. And then I turned my back, walked towards the other end. By the time I got to the centre line, I turned around, there was no one on the baseline. And they're over getting a drink. And I said, Lulu, what the heck? What did you say to him, mate? I told you to get him to form groups of four on the baseline. He goes, oh, I thought you told him to go get a drink. I said, oh, good Lord. This is going to go well. This is my first, off-season.
A non-English-speaking translator. Yeah. I love it.
No, he was good. And then we formed a great relationship, and I upskilled him quickly, and we hung out together as much as we could so he could learn as much English. And, he's very good now.
The Seattle Storm are up 46-30 at halftime, Timsy.
Yeah, end of story. Just can't get excited about that final series, sorry. Good on Birdie, though. Got a lot of love for Birdie, you know, at that age, and she's just been had a super career and can still go. It's like Taurasi can still go at that age. Fantastic.
I shudder to think how good a coach both of those two ladies will be. Yeah. They are both
Taurasi, I'm tipping it. Taurasi will end up in the NBA.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. She's really, like, not only is she GOAT, she's also so well respected amongst the NBA already. She'll definitely, I have no doubt, she'll pop up somewhere.
We spoke about that probably on our last podcast about the number of female coaches that are starting to hit into the NBA ranks as well.
Like, Buchek, she's just popped up. Where Dallas. Dallas. Yeah.
I butchered her name horrifically on the last podcast. Nancy Lieberman.
Is Lieberman back in it, is she? I know she's doing
Sacramento.
The 3-on-3.
Okay, awesome.
And she coached 3-on-3 men's team.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
Sacramento. Yeah.
Well, I had the fortune of playing with her in her first year at Phoenix. It's unbelievable.
Awesome.
I haven't seen a player pass the ball like she could. And it was no wonder that she played in the NBA, played with the men. She was just, she was at the very end, like she was old when she played in the WNBA that first year, but I'm glad she did, you know, and you could get it, you got a glimpse of how good she was when in her younger day. Fair dinkum, her passing was phenomenal.
And hence why she's a very good coach now. We speak a little bit about, not a little bit, we've touched the topic of female coaching here often on the pod, and it's something that we think we can do a better job of, just engaging females to take part in pathways here in Australia and take on jobs here in Australia as well. And I was with the TCU women's basketball staff yesterday, and they were telling me about their program and just what they've got on the horizon. And the head coach told me that when they have a job opening there, applications come in, and for every one female application that comes in, 30 male applications come in for an assistant coaching spot. And we think that we got challenges here in Australia getting females to coach females here in Australia, but it looks like it's a worldwide thing from the research I'm doing. So would you have any advice for up-and-coming coaches or people trying to navigate a pathway to get to, and it's different for everyone. Everyone can try as hard as they want. They won't get the same end result eventually. But any thoughts around like our young up-and-coming coaches and those ones trying to navigate, you know, the Victorian pathway or the Basketball Australia pathway?
I probably don't. My pathway was very different.
And that's one thing we've spoken about. Yeah. It looks different for everybody.
Yeah, it is. And I think that everyone has to understand that it is, it can come in different shapes and forms. But I definitely, since I've been back, I've been involved in one beginner coaching course, and it was interesting then. There were a lot of women there, and probably half and half, you know. And the interesting thing for me that I really consciously noted was that the women, they didn't like asking questions. It was always the men asked the questions, but the women, for some reason, I don't know why, maybe they were intimidated or unsure of, you know. But it was a beginner's coaching course, so there was bound to be a lot of questions. And then that you know, made me think, well, maybe I need to start running some, you know, female-only coaching course, because if it's a confidence thing or something like that, you know, we can help the women find their confidence and let them know, look, no question is a dumb question, you know. So I don't have an answer for you, but it's definitely something that's worth looking into as to why.
Well, you know, we're going to have a conversation off air about this, Timsy, because this is very much in my wheelhouse. It is an issue that, you know, we're finding at the moment is that there are a lot of females that would be outstanding coaches that don't want to put their hand up, and we've got to try and find out why that is and remove as many roadblocks as we can. Really good female coaches are amazing, and we find that a lot of female athletes want to play for female coaches.
I must admit, when I played, I didn't care who, I just wanted the best person, the best coach I could get, whether man or woman. But that's interesting that you've had feedback from what I was happy about, though, was it was coming back into Australia and being around the VJBL again. Michelle Brogan, Michelle Cleary, all my old teammates are now McInerney, so many of the old WNBL players and Opals players putting back into the program and coaching. And, you know, you're just reeling off some names then, the smartest players I think I've ever played with, along with Robin Maher. But Michelle Brogan, high Q, through the roof. And it's great to see Sam Thornton doing so well as, you know, in the coaching box. So there's it's been really great catching up and seeing bits and pieces. Oh, there's another Opal coaching now. There's another, you know, it's really good.
No, it is, and it's a fantastic pathway and great linkage for the players to actually, and it's amazing how many, I don't know that too many of the players would actually understand who their coaches are.
No, like some of those names, they don't.
They wouldn't understand what they've done in their playing career either. Yeah. So it's a really valuable way of sort of passing on the history, I think, as well, which is fantastic. Absolutely. So that pretty much wraps me up. You got anything more?
Last question, Timsy.
Your questions are hard. Come on now.
That's what I'm here for, Timsy.
Yeah,
that's
the tough question.
This will be the toughest one,
all
I
right,
promise
okay.
you. True or false?
Uh-oh.
You once had a tenant of your house called Justin Shuler.
True.
Was he ever late on his rent payment?
Never. And kept the place immaculate.
Good
and,
on him.
Yep. I was really lucky to have him in there. And then it was great because then I got to be a bit of a groupie whenever he took the national team away or was involved with the national team. And he was like, yeah, go boys, you know.
That sounds just like our man.
Hey, for those of you looking to do camps on the school holidays, get involved with the academy as well, how can people get in contact with you?
Just michelletimsacademy.tmat.com. Jump on there. We've got an elite girls under 12 and 14s camp happening on the 25th and 6th of September, and the boys under 12 and 14 elite camp on the 2nd and 3rd at the brand new Mulla Mullum Stadium that I've got to say...
Beautiful,
it's
isn't
just
it?
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's staggeringly good. We had Lono there a couple of weeks ago, and it's the first time I'd walked in there. And obviously, you do your workouts there on a Monday night, Mike, and you said, oh, yeah, it's pretty good. I didn't quite understand what pretty good meant in your language. It's staggeringly good. Yeah, so so definitely get in contact with Timsy if you are interested.
Not many spots left, though, but yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That'd be fantastic.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Really
great to be back,
on.
And I love your podcast. It's great.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Big thanks to Michelle Timms for giving up her time, especially when the WNBA finals are on, though, from the sounds of things. Not a lot of interest.
She's loving this series, yeah. Robbie. and loves everything non-Phoenix related.
Exactly. So, unfortunately, her Phoenix Mercury did get rolled a couple of weeks ago, but great to have her on the podcast.
Awesome,
so,
mate.
Again, like an incredible resume from playing and coaching experience.
And even just the end of the pod right there, or at the end of the chat with Timsy, and she started to rattle off some of the ladies we have in basketball circles here in Melbourne, currently coaching, who have represented us at Olympic Games and World Championships, is amazing.
It is incredible.
It is amazing.
And that's at the grassroots level of the sport.
Oh, so under 12s and under 14s throughout the VJBL.
So if that's the exposure that our athletes are getting at a young age with people of that calibre, with that level of knowledge as well, it can only be a good thing for the sport.
Right, I completely agree. And then it is our duty now to get them also on the same floor as our elite developing athletes as well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, they should coach their teams and help their teams at the club level, but we also have some identified elite athletes who we also need to get these ladies on the floor with.
No question at all. So, a couple of things, well, a number of things, I suppose, out of that.
Hmm.
The emphasis on shooting. So, music to our ears,
yep.
Obviously.
Yep.
You know, the more time and more detail we can give our athletes to become better shooters,
yeah.
The more likely they are to succeed.
It's interesting that she spoke about it at an international level that, yep. And it's interesting, you speak to college coaches or you speak to people from abroad and they love Australians for the competitiveness, the IQ, and I often hear, whether or not it's right or wrong, shooting ability. And I think, it's interesting. Our best shooters, of course, are going to make shots, but where's the median between our great shooters and the rest of our basketball players?
Yep.
So, interesting that Timsy, not prompted, came up with that one. And
yep.
She talked a lot about the prevalence of on-ball basketball.
Yep.
In her time in China, international basketball, obviously Olympic Games, just how good you have to be offensively, but she talked about defensively, like the team that
Absolutely.
Defends the on-ball screen is usually going to come with the Chokies.
And you can imagine what their practices are like too. Like we see it a lot with the Asian style of basketball as well. It's very dribble penetration heavy, can usually shoot the ball fairly well, so an on-ball screen can just cause chaos amongst teams' defences. So the fact that they use it so often, I suppose, and the fact that they will see it in pretty much every game. Like, if you watch an international game of basketball, you would struggle to get one possession where you do not see an on-ball screen. Like,
yeah.
You're going to have it in some way, shape, or form,
yep.
where it's a drag pick, a mid-pick, a punch pick, whatever it is, you will see an on-ball screen in pretty much everything. And just the way teams can score out of that now, sometimes it's a bit of a decoy action to set up something else.
Right.
Other times it's just a straight up bad luck. We're giving our best player the ball and we're setting it on ball.
Kind of makes you think about what you do in your practice too. We spoke about just your shell drill and think about how many pin downs are set or down screens are set per game versus how many side on balls. And when you have a program or a professional or semi-professional international program, where you have resources that can chart all these things, they will help dictate what you cover in practice. But for our coaches coaching junior basketball, like what do your games look like and what is the most prevalent action that you do have to think about and talk about and drill with your team so that you have a chance of guarding it successfully on the weekend?
I don't know a lot of coaches, and I certainly went in down this path, I suppose, when I first started. My shell drill always started with just no bouncing.
Mm.
And so it was always just pass and cut, and get to that. We don't really see a lot of kids anymore get burnt on cutting action. it tends to be all dribble penetration related. Where do they help from? How do they defend the on-ball screen? So I'd probably suggest a little bit more time with shell drill with on-ball screens from various different actions. Handoffs as well are a massive part of the game. They're effectively on-balls anyway. Would be a great way to go.
I saw a coach's clinic a little while ago now, but the coach was Coach Woodley, who worked for worked for Washington State with Tony Bennett for a while, coached in the D-League, and he's had a rule that anything less than 5-on-5, so 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, whenever they were in 2-on-2, 3-on-3, or 4-on-4 at practice, were automatically in black, which was their switching package. And they essentially just switched, didn't matter what the drill is, 3-on-3 full court, 4-on-4 shell, but if it was less than 5-on-5, they were automatically in black, which always had now built-in switching as a component of what we're practicing. So I thought that was a pretty interesting way to get switching into what you're doing without saying, hey, we're switching in this drill.
Yep. And that generally is the hardest thing to deal with, is switching man-to-man defenses. So off on-ball screens, that is probably one of the few areas that teams probably haven't really got their head around how to attack it, because there are teams that will say, hey, we're taking the ball away from it, we're just going to ISO this out. Do you stay within your offensive structure? I mean, there's a different answer for everything, obviously, but switching defenses is probably one of the best ways to negate on-ball screens.
And you need a switch package now, Robbie. Timsy did talk about when teaching. She used the word teaching a lot when she was speaking about her time in China and how she taught the under 14, under 16 athletes over there. I thought that was really good. Did you hear Timsy talk about Tom Ma and her, him being her favourite coach, or coach that had great influence on her, and it had nothing to do with any set or action or anything. It was because he was ever evolving and trying to find the best solutions for the ball club, and he was a great communicator and he empowered the team that he was coaching. So I thought all that was really good when you talk about what qualities does she see in elite coaches around the world.
Absolutely. So massive thanks to Michelle Timms, obviously, for jumping on the podcast, especially when WNBA playoffs are on. It's a huge appreciation from our end.
I don't believe that Shula was on time every time with his rent.
No, not a chance. No, like, and I would strongly suggest the bond did not get returned to Shula at the end of it. I hear about some of the parties used to have at that place, and very lucky Timsy might have been in a different continent.
Yeah, good cleaning service.
Yeah, that too.
Weekend news, right?
Weekend news. So, because it's been 2 weeks, we've been 2 weeks since we've had this, so we've got an abundance of news to get to you guys. Father's Day, massive announcement, obviously, at the State Basketball Centre, with a whole range of funding coming down for the State Basketball Centre here, with additional courts coming in, with Knox Basketball, with Victorian Government, which coincided with the announcement of the new NBL franchise being based out of South East Melbourne. See, now my geography's bad and my ability to use a Melways is worse.
But
I can guarantee you Werribee is nowhere near the southeast part of Melbourne.
Just got to turn left, Robbie.
Yeah, no good. So we have no idea what the team's going to be called. You can guarantee Justin Shuler's probably already applied for the coaching position there in some way, shape or form. But fantastic news for the area. I mean, it's a massive basketball fraternity, I suppose, out this side of town as well. It is huge.
It's a huge announcement, mate. Like, and now I guess basketball circles and people at this side are rooting for Labor to get in and
casting a vote one way or the
other, for Liberal to get on the bandwagon and do the same thing, which would be awesome for us to be covered both ways. So I mean, it's just, you know, we know we've got a court shortage here in Melbourne, and the honest, that's like a drop in the ocean, the extension to here. We need courts in every pocket of town. So I think it's just awesome that there is some investment going on in basketball, and that the people of Melbourne, and this is like the hotbed of basketball out this side of town, that there is some stuff on the horizon, and a new NBL team out here, they'd have some built-in support by plonking it out here.
I would have thought so. And your default is to obviously support whichever Victorian team Justin is not a part of.
No. Whoever gives the tickets, Robbie. Whoever gives the tickets.
I get it. So big congratulations to everyone involved with that. So obviously really the Kesselman world that is the NBL, also all the BV staff and people that have had input into getting the funding over the line.
I think what's good is it's a ninth and a tenth team now.
Yep.
if I'm right by saying that. And then talk about Tasmania.
The next team coming in.
You know, a 12-team national competition would be pretty good.
Huge.
Would be pretty good. Yeah. Give some athletes a greater chance to leave college, come into the league. Give some of those
stay.
Give some of those development players a chance to go from DP to a roster spot next year. And just, you know, an exciting thing where now we've got 12 teams and we can watch, we don't have to watch the same game all the time. We've got you know, various opponents and different rivalries and road trips, and you have to do a Melbourne swing now and play Melbourne and Southeast Melbourne or wherever, or whoever, wherever it's going, Robbie. We can't speculate.
We can speculate. We're probably not right, but we can always speculate.
But they're awesome.
No, it is huge news. Big news with the announcement that the WNBL will be back on free-to-air on SBS games this year fantastic news for the league.
Absolutely.
WNBA playoffs. Our very own Australian, Sammy Whitcomb, gets a title with the Seattle Storm. Mm-hmm. They rolled through the Washington Mystics today. So huge news in that area, as well as Liz Cambidge being named an all-WNBA team as well. So big news there.
She had a great year.
Huge.
Great year.
Huge. But pretty much double doubles, and like some of the lines you put up were out of control. Like there was a game where it was 50 odd points.
Yeah,
And got near that a couple of times
on 20 something shots, which is Robbie Coulter efficiency.
No, it is not. Unfortunately, Women's World Cup is.
Yeah, I'm excited for that, Robbie.
Yep,
I'm excited for that one. That's the ladies are over in Europe right now. I think they've been in France for a little bit, maybe in Turkey, playing some exhibitions and practice games and. Anything that is World Cup related is exciting.
Absolutely.
And to see the ladies play, and there's going to be good access. We heard Timsy say you can watch it all through the FIBA app, and YouTube does a great, or FIBA does a great job to get all their stuff through YouTube, and I'm not sure what Fox Sports' stance is on it, but it's going to be accessible, which is awesome.
And we've got a good team. Like, we are a good shot at medaling this year. I don't know that there's too many players, if we had our full strength team, that would be missing, which is fantastic. Shot clock in the NCAA. This is in your wheelhouse.
High school. So
we're not getting to the NCAA.
Came across my desk last week, Robbie, that Texas and North Carolina have passed bylaws to implement shot clocks in their high school system, which is a huge move for them. I think because, I guess, and speaking with kind of your people away from the US who would say American high school is great athleticism, but their IQ maybe not as good as what is happening internationally. Shot clock will bring about some development of IQ, because now you got to make decisions. And the dribbling the clock out, which is still prevalent in high school basketball in the US, can't happen because there's a shot clock. So I think it's a big move from two of the bigger high school states and two of the states that Australian teams are allowed to go and play in when they do take international tours. So good move from Texas and North Carolina.
I like it. And that wraps us up for this week.
Number 35, Robbie.
35.
Timsy, impressive. Thank you to Michelle.
She was fantastic.
Awesome.
You can grab all her details online.
Yep. And we'll get back at it next week, Robbie. Another guest, I think, is on the horizon next week for us.
Potentially. If not, you get to hear us again.
That's not all bad. That's a win.
Not all bad. But again, big thanks to everyone that does subscribe, share, retweet.
BJBL prelim finals. Maybe some semis, some grand finals.
That would be
tomorrow.
Grand finals for VJL.
Yeah.
Tomorrow. And Saturday, I think, even Sunday, I believe.
And
VC Final Four this weekend.
Semis and or prelims, they call them prelims.
Yeah, whatever prelim. You want to call them. Good luck to all the coaches out there. I will not be one of them. You will not be one of them. Good luck to everyone. Thanks for everyone talking sport with us.